Good afternoon and welcome to our STS-135 Flight Readiness Review News Conference, which followed today's meeting here at Kennedy Space Center to determine the launch date for STS-135. And with us today on our panel, NASA's Associate Administrator for Space Operations, Mr. Bill Gerstenmaier.
Good afternoon.
Space Shuttle Program Launch Integration Manager, Mike Moses.
Good afternoon.
And Shuttle Launch Director, Mike Leinbach.
Good afternoon, everybody.
We'll begin with comments, and then we'll be happy to take your questions. Mr. Gerstenmaier.
Thanks, Mike. We set July 8th for the launch. I think the in-plane time is 11:26 a.m. We had a very thorough review, like our previous FRRs. We spent quite a bit of time going over each activity that is going to occur on this flight. There's some unique things that are associated with this flight. The fact that we have four crew members cuts down a little bit on some of the crew time to get things done, so we had to make some adjustments to make sure that that would all fit, and that all worked out well. We also have the unique contingency crew support plan. In case we have orbiter damage, we're going to use the Soyuz spacecraft, which we've talked about before. We reviewed that in a lot of detail. We went over exactly what equipment is pre-positioned where, what our options are if we go into that activity. And kind of the bottom outcome of that whole discussion was that even though we're using a different means to provide crew rescue capability, it's at least as good as what we had with the shuttle. In some ways, it's actually better than what we had with the shuttle, and the fact that we would have some medical capability to return crew members on a Soyuz if we needed to sometime during that period. So there's some unique advantages of this alternate scenario, that it's not just a one-for-one difference. There's actually a good trade between the two. We spent quite a bit of time talking about that. We also reviewed the previous anomalies we saw on the vehicles that flew before. We talked about the tire fire that we saw on the runway post-landing. Again, we think that's almost a nominal kind of occurrence. The small amount of brake fluid or hydraulic fluid that could be there that would flash would leave no soot, didn't trip any temp sensors. There's some very small wires in that area, so there was no really heat associated with that. It could be an occurrence that actually occurs during daylight landings if there's a small amount of fluid there that would burn off or flash off, and we would not see it during a daylight landing. But we reviewed that in extensive details. We went over really a very thorough review. I was continually impressed by the teams, how much they continue to dig into each and every problem. We talked about the main engine valve that leaked during the tanking test. We spent quite a bit of time going over that. They've dismantled the valve out in California. They found a small particle in the valve on the valve seat that could be a contributor to what we saw on the pad. So that's an encouraging thing, that by changing that component out, we've got a good configuration out on the launch pad. I was also tremendously impressed by the team and the ability for them to keep working. Issues that come up, the fuel valve changeout was new work for the teams down here at Kennedy. They did a great job of working that into the flow and getting that activity done. So again, I think overall it was a very thorough review. It wasn't much different than our other flight readiness reviews. As I've told you before, I kind of, you know, really wanted us to stay on target and keep thinking about the mission in front of us, keep thinking about the task that we've got to go do. This flight is incredibly important to space station. The cargo that is coming up on this flight is really mandatory for space station. You can see that in our minimum duration flight duration for this mission. It's a 10-day mission, and that essentially allows us to get all the cargo off of the MPLM and return some cargo on the MPLM in the shuttle, even if in the event we have a shuttle anomaly that wants us to return early. So that kind of implies to you how critical this mission is from a resupply standpoint, that we're willing to stay on orbit with some small orbiter failures to get these minimum critical transfer tasks done. So the teams have done a great job. I think they did a tremendous job today of staying on point, talking about what we needed to talk about, get ready for the mission, get ready for the launch, and make sure that we are really ready to go do this mission like we've done the missions before. So there wasn't much discussion, no fanfare, no unique activities at all with the FRR. I tried to keep it as much as we could. And the only thing at the end was a little different was that Mike Soffredini gave a picture to John Shannon of the fly around of the orbiter attached to station. So the station program has its self-portrait, per se, or Soyuz portrait, I guess. And I'll turn it over to Mike for any other comments.
All right, thanks, Bill. Let's see, as Bill mentioned, a really thorough review today. He covered a lot of the technical issues. We also talked an unexplained anomaly that we had. We saw in some of the imagery on the last mission right at SRB SEP, one of the cameras we have mounted on the SRB that looks back at the external tank, inner tank, captured a little cylindrical debris piece tumbling by. We've never seen anything like that before, and so it really got us curious as to what that could be. We've done an extensive investigation of all the returned hardware. Nothing's missing. All the on-orbit photos we took of the external tank, since we don't recover that, and we didn't see anything there that looked like it was obvious. We then went to the next level and just literally looked at all the components in that system up near that attach point and looked from a geometrical perspective what parts are there that look like that and what could be in that area, and went through all that exhaustive stuff. At the end of the day, we really didn't come up with any candidates. We found one component in the SRB system as it attaches to the external tank. There's a grounding strap that basically connects the external tank side hardware over to the SRB side hardware. And there's two connectors that plug into a little coupler, and the coupler can detach on either end. So as this, if you think of it, it's a string with a connector in the middle, and it pulls apart. One end's going to come off and not the other. It's, if you have a little connector in the middle and you pull, it's not going to come off on both sides. Whichever one's got the lowest pull force will release. We get this part back on the SRBs about half the time. We see that the coupler's on the SRB side. The assumption is the other half of the time it's on the ET side, but we really can't prove that. We did a lot of testing and analysis and pull testing to show that we can't make this come off in both sides at the same time and make this uncontained debris. So it's a very unlikely release point, but it's about the only thing left in the system that geometrically looks like that would be exposed at that same time frame. So we kind of focused on that as our worst case look. And we looked at it just to make sure we understood what would happen if it did come off. And again, the real rationale there is it's an extremely unlikely thing to happen. We validated our design. We did tests to show that we cannot create this piece of debris to liberate. But even if it did, we have high confidence in our tools, our on-orbit inspections, and our imagery techniques to be able to detect if it did hit the shuttle and cause damage to the orbiter. We would detect that and then be able to implement all the processes we have in place to address any damage that it might cause if it did actually release and then did actually transport and hit us. But it was, again, like Bill said, a testament to the investigation. Even here with one flight to go, we went to the nth degree to look what possibly could be there. We did a bunch of testing. We did a bunch of camera testing to really try to verify and validate that we understood, even though it was an unexplained piece of debris, that we really did understand as much as we possibly could and understand the risk that poses to us, and deemed that it was not at all to a level where we needed to be worried about it, and it was acceptable to go ahead and fly, even though we don't know exactly what the source of that debris was. On the external tank side, we did a tanking test now 2 weeks ago. The main purpose there was to test the modifications we made to the inner tank stringers. You'll recall a few missions back we had cracks on those stringers that we had to modify. This tank is flying inner tank stringers made from that same metal from the lot that is a little defective. And so we needed to preemptively go reinforce the inner tank. We did that. The tanking test was just kind of the icing on the cake to verify that we truly understood all our models and all our inputs, that there were no other forces at work that would cause cracks. We did x-rays of the oxygen side flange and the hydrogen side flange as they faced the shuttle, so on the front side of that tank, and found no cracks at all, so that tanking test went off really well. At the same time, we were able to get a good check of the foam on the external tank. It performed fantastic. It looks like it's in really great shape. And as Bill said, it had the secondary effect of, in the main engine system, as we were flowing the cold hydrogen through, we discovered a leaky valve on the main engine that on launch day would have caused us a scrub and had to go in and do an R&R that would have delayed us about a week. So it was really fortuitous to have that one identified ahead of time and screened out. A kind of a reinforcement of it doesn't hurt to test what you fly every once in a while just to know what you're doing. So that was a really good thing. The SRB guys showed us we had a parachute fail on one of the SRBs. One of the three on an SRB had a rip go through it. Again, they went through to the nth degree to look at all the different things that could happen. We haven't had very many chutes fail in the history of the program, but the damage is there to show that this was probably deployment damage. It kind of a rub as it comes out of the canister. It kind of probably caused some heating and reefed a little early, a little higher rate. It was also the first chute on that set of three to reef. Therefore, it took the highest load, and it just basically ripped itself apart. The other two chutes carried the load just fine. Impact velocity was right about what it should be. The system's designed to have a chute failure without any problems at all. But again, another good testament of the detail that we went into, even on the last flight, to make sure we understood the hardware, For that, that's a recovery thing. You know, it doesn't affect the safety of the crew at all, but we did want to make sure we understood that we didn't have any pre-existing problems that might affect the next flight. And then, as Bill said, on the orbiter side, we talked a little bit about that brake fire, just to make sure we truly understood its condition. So, again, really good example of the detail we went into. But to focus on the mission a second, just to go through some of the details, I don't think you guys have had the pre-flight briefings yet from the MOD folks, and so you'll hear a lot of this at the end of the week. But basically, it's a 12-day mission. We're looking to try to get an extra day. Right now, it's a 12 plus zero. We don't have the consumables to have an extra day. But that's bookkeeping a fair number of things. One is to give Mike and the launch team some launch attempts before we have to top off those cryo tanks. If we happen to go on time on the first attempt, we'll carry a little bit of extra cryo up to orbit. And then the other thing they've looked at is the MPLM, as it's in the cargo bay, has some shell heaters in it, basically some low-temp heaters that turn on just to keep the temperatures and the condensation down. They've looked at the specific attitude we're flying and the specific thermal profile, and the station program is okay to not turn those heaters on before we dock and then also leave them off after we undock. That power savings will be enough, if we do go on time, to potentially give us or get us very close to having the capability of adding an extra day. We'll call that an energy-dependent day. We'll have to wait and assess that. We'll go ahead and get docked to station. We'll go ahead and not power up those heaters. And then after about 2 or 3 days of docked to station, we'll see how the consumption's going and be able to make the decision on whether we have enough to stay up one more day. As Bill said, it's pretty important to us. In addition to all the cargo going up to station, one of the things I found interesting today is the MPLM's packed about a third full of food. It's taken up about a year's supply of food. The return cargo is also equally important to get off of station. Some of it's in the ORU science we want back, but a lot of it's in the just trash and clean up the stowage situation on station. We're kind of doing a surge here and pre-stowing a lot of gear up on station to get us another year of lifetime in case we do have some problems with the commercial orbital resupply vehicles that are out there and they get delayed. So this is try to guys buy some insurance. But what that does is put the stowage situation on station in a real crunch. So the most we can offload the stuff they don't need, the better. To fit the timeline, the MPLM's coming back about 75 to 80% full. If we could get that extra day on orbit, we'd be able to get it packed 100% full and be able to get the last little bit of stuff off station. So it's a really important goal for us. We're not going to do anything heroic to get it, but it is something we're going to strive to try to gain that extra day if we can and turn this into a 13-day mission. Just to step through the timeline, flight day 3 is the regular rendezvous and dock. On flight day 4, we'll go put the MPLM on station. Flight day 5 will be the only EVA for this mission, and it's going to be it'll be done out of the ISS airlock, just like all the EVAs that we've done lately. But it'll be the station crew doing that EVA, not the shuttle crew. With the 4-person shuttle crew, we wanted to keep their training requirements to a minimum and not have them have to have any specific EVA training. So the station team will be going out. Their main tasks are basically in the back of the payload bay. In addition to the MPLM, we're flying an LMC cargo carrier. It's just a cross-bay cargo carrier. On the way uphill, there is a robotics refueling module, an RRM, made by the Goddard Space Flight Center that's basically a testbed for robotics refueling demos. It's kind of a very fancy tinker toy Lego system for the SPDM to go up on orbit and try and practice techniques of how you do remote refueling of satellites. That's going to be left on station, and then we're flying up an empty carrier to bring back down with us the failed pump module, if you remember. Well, it's now probably gone on a year. We've had one of our external thermal cooling loop system pump modules failed. We do want to bring that one back for failure analysis. So it's up on station right now waiting to bring back down. So the tasks of the EVA are to basically bring the failed pump module back into the payload bay, take this refueling module over to station, stow it on station, and then a couple other get-ahead tasks out on the exterior station. So that's EVA day. The MPLM would stay out until flight day 10 when it gets put back in the shuttle payload bay, and then the next day would be undocking. And it looks like a normal timeline after that, even though it's a 4-person crew. We'd undock, do a fly around, and then do our late inspection. One other thing we're going to do, in addition, you saw last time we wanted to get the Soyuz fly around to get some of that engineering view and just the aesthetic views of a shuttle dock to station. This time we normally do a fly around. The shuttle comes out, backs off, and then does a fly around what we call the X-axis of the station, which is the views you've seen all along, that kind of the station solar rays make it look like a TIE fighter up in orbit. This time we're going to back out the R-bar. The station's going to turn 90 degrees and point its long axis at us. So the truss with the solar arrays on it are going to be pointed at the station or at the shuttle, and then we'll fly around that long axis. And so we'll get a different angle on some of the hardware. Some of those pieces of station don't get quite the photographic coverage that they would on a normal shuttle fly around. So we're going to do this one to try to gain some last-minute views before we lose that capability of having those high-resolution pictures taken by the shuttle crew. To save time, because we have to wait while the station maneuvers 90 degrees, we're only going to do a half of a lap fly around. We're not going to go the whole way around. So a half a lap on a different axis should provide us some pretty unique views of the station for an engineering evaluation of how that system's doing after so many years up in orbit. Flight day 13 is entry, setting us up for a landing on July 20th. I think the time's tweaking a little bit, but it's around 7 a.m. local time. It was 6:30 for a while, but that's going to be, there's some reboosts going on in the station, so that time's going to move just a little bit. But it's in the ballpark of 7 a.m. on July 20th, which is pretty historical data to be landing anyway. So that's the mission in a nutshell. It seems simple on paper. It's just an MPLM, but like Bill said, the stuff inside that MPLM is unbelievably critical to the future of space station, and so it's going to take a lot of effort to get it all out and repacked and in the right config. So really looking forward to achieving this mission, putting station where it needs to be, and finishing strong with the shuttle program here with STS-135.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Well, see, Atlantis is in great shape out the pad. The remaining pad flow is very, very standard for us. We got our ordnance connected up last night. We'll close the payload bay doors for flight tomorrow afternoon. Tomorrow evening and Thursday morning, we'll pressurize the high-pressure gas bottles on the orbiter. Those are the MPS and hyper bottles that pressurize those systems. We'll close out the aft by Friday, and we'll be able to take all 3 days of the holiday weekend off, come back to pick up launch countdown on Tuesday the 5th, and it's going to be very, very easy pad flow for us the remainder of the way, not expecting anything to crop up that would cause us to work this weekend. The launch countdown itself is really one of the most standard ones we've had in quite some time. We do not have a PRSD offload this time. It's a non-Spitz vehicle, and so we will not be offloading any of the locks in the fuel cell system. And the rest of the countdown is very standard. We'll go for opening of the launch window at 11:21 local time on the 8th, preferred time 11:26, and that's probably what we'll shoot for. From a scrub turnaround perspective, there is a delta on the range on the 14th, and that will cause us to stand down after our launch attempt on the 10th. So we have attempts on the 8th, 9th, and 10th, and then we would stand down for the delta. So that would give us two attempts in 3 days, and hopefully that'll be plenty. 24 versus 48, if we get into a scrub scenario on launch day, Mike and I will look at the reason for the scrub and the time of the scrub itself relative to the visitors in town. Again, we're expecting somewhere between 500,000 and 750,000 visitors in the local communities that would cause a launch team and all other processing elements a delay in getting home and being able to come back for a 24-hour scrub turnaround if we scrub late in the launch window. So we have that plan in place from a few flights ago, and we'll implement that if we need to. So Team Atlantis is feeling good about the flow and the launch countdown, and hopefully we'll be able to get her off the ground on Friday the 8th on the schedule. Mike?
Okay, thank you, Mike. We'll begin with questions here at Kennedy Space Center, and then we'll go over to Johnson Space Center in Houston, and then take a question from the phone line, and then return to Kennedy to follow up and wrap things up. Please wait for the microphone, state your name and affiliation, and to whom you're addressing your question, and we'll start with Marcia.
Marcia Dunn, Associated Press for Bill. You mentioned the Soyuz rotation and how that, you know, would play in. Is 1 in 560 still the best risk estimate for that possibly happening?
Well, I don't know.
That's the number that the commander had been using for a while.
Yeah, I don't know what that would be based on. I don't know. We'd have to go. We'll have to go look at that and get back with you. That doesn't ring a bell to me because our MMOD is slightly different. Other things are different. So I don't know where that comes from. But we'll do a little homework and figure out where that number comes from and see if it's the right number. It probably is if the commander said. I'm just not familiar with it.
That's fine. And it would be four separate Soyuz coming up for each of the four, or would two of them be piggybacking on one potentially? Could you just review how that would work? Because I've heard different scenarios for that as well.
Yeah, I think we would again, kind of play it by ear and see which way we'd go. We could actually put two on a couple Soyuz. We have one seat liner in the MPLM that's going up on shuttle that could be used right away with one of the Soyuz, if that makes sense. The way we laid it out, at least for planning purposes, we left all the Soyuzes on their original launch dates where they are right now in the manifest. It turns out there's 7 resupply options during that period. There's 7 progress vehicles that will be flying during that period. So there's lots of options to carry up unique supplies and gear. So what I think where we do it is we looked at it kind of from a worst case, which is leave everything where it is and perturb the manifest the absolute minimum that we could. And that's totally acceptable to us. But then we would see how the situation panned out. We'd see where we are with consumables. We'd see how well we are with crew health, how things are moving, and then we can adapt and change around. So it's a very flexible plan, and really what we did is we laid out to make sure that there was a credible path through this plan that could lead to success and could get our crews home in the remote possibility that we had to go do this to get rid of an orbiter on orbit. And again, I think I stress to everyone, even in the review, is that we don't really think this is a likely case. This is kind of due diligence on our part to make sure we are prepared, that we have laid out a logical plan that we can use and implement if this problem occurs. And that's the way we treat it. It's got lots of flexibility in it, and the exact way we would implement it will kind of depend upon how exactly things break as we go through the process.
Jay.
Yeah, Bill, I have a real long question here. When Atlantis goes up, that's the last vehicle you have or even in your plans that can do an external EVA or repair. No airlocks, the way I understand it, are planned on any future vehicles. Now, with that out, when you first started launching the space station, NASA made the promise to this planet that it would bring back a controlled space station and put it in the Pacific Ocean because of the problems that we had with Skylab. Skylab, they thought was going to hit, as you remember, the Pacific Ocean, wound up hitting the outlands of Australia. With the station 3 times larger than Skylab, you would lay a footprint across the whole United States almost with lethal debris if you had an uncontrolled space station come back that you could not repair in orbit. But let's suppose that we get through all the potential hazards. We never have to abandon the space station, and 2020 rolls around, and you've got to come up with a plan. So, a way I'm told you have 3 choices. You can continue the space station, build a space city on it, continue it perpetually in orbit, or you can return it home, or you could destroy it to smithereens in orbit with all of these small pieces coming back in. But how can you, without the shuttle, do you have enough propulsion on board with the space station system itself or using smaller rockets and all to control the space station and bring it back safely without being a threat to the population?
The answer to that is yes. And what we've done is we're required to protect propellant on board to keep adequate attitude control for space station. So, in fact, you'll see us start raising the altitude of station, and that's because the solar maximum is picking up and the drag is increasing on station. So we have a requirement to be 180 days away from where we would drift down to an altitude where we would have problems. And then we need to keep enough propellant on board that we can actually reboost ourselves higher so we can have 360 days before we drift down to this altitude where it becomes tough to control the space station. So we've got a basic plan that we're going to stay well above the altitude that we required to keep attitude control on space station. We have multitude of redundancy in our attitude control systems. We can use the progress vehicles to provide attitude control. We can use the service module thrusters to provide attitude control. As you well know, our control moment gyros can provide attitude control. There's 4 of those. We have 4 spares of control moment gyros on orbit. We can replace those. We only need 2 of those to maintain attitude control. We can probably maintain attitude control with just 1 of those. So in a whole variety of scenarios, we are going to keep attitude control. And if we can keep attitude control, it's relatively easy to target to put space station into a deorbit path that would deorbit it into the ocean and would not put any risk at all on the Earth as long as we can maintain attitude control. So we have adequate ability to keep it from a system standpoint. As you saw last summer when our ammonia pump went down, we have the ability to do EVAs out of the space station, which we can do. We can repair components. We have the spare parts on orbit to do those things, and we'll do that before we degrade down to where we would lose attitude control. We also have a limited capability to do EVAs out of the Soyuz. The Soyuz has an orbital compartment. You can use that orbital compartment to do some limited EVAs, so we do have, even in a remote contingency situation, ability to do some EVAs from the Soyuz. Then the last thing is our components, our attitude control hardware on side space station. It's designed to operate at a vacuum. So if we had some evacuation event that took all the pressure out of space station, the electronics components that keep these attitude control systems are there, and we would use those to maintain attitude control. So if we lose attitude control, even if we had a shuttle, it's really tough to get a shuttle up there to dock with the solar arrays and the radiators and all that component to capture a tumbling station to come. So our job, whether we had a shuttle or not, is to prevent that occurrence from happening, and we need to make sure we keep attitude control. And I believe, you know, you can't say it's impossible, but there's a tremendous amount of robustness that keeps us from losing attitude control, which ultimately provides us with the capability to do a safe deorbit of space station.
So the bottom line is, unless you have a derelict, something that you have no control over, people killed on board, abandoned, that's the only threat that you're a situation where you're going to have a threat of this coming in uncontrolled and hitting the planet. Is that what you're saying?
It would have to be a pretty unique set of multiple circumstances that you know, if you got hit by some large piece of debris and portions of the station were evacuated, we would still have attitude control. We could still do those things. So there's probably a case. I don't know how to string it together, but I'm sure if we sat around long enough, we could come up with a case. But it's going to be multiple failures deep where we would be in this situation.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Irene.
Thanks. Irene Klotz with Reuters. I have a couple questions for you, Bill. Do you have any identification of that orbital debris that caused the Soyuz shelter this morning?
No, we don't know what it. We don't know what it's. It doesn't have an ID. It just it lists in our table as unknown. It's in a fairly highly elliptic orbit. It's inclined at about 62 degrees inclination. We did some post-pass tracking information where we tracked the object after it came past station. And then if we kind of backtrack to how close it came to station, we think it came within about 335 meters of space station based on kind of just the best estimate of our trajectory back calculating. So it was probably the closest object to space station that has actually come by space station. And we didn't have any information that it was coming until it was very, very close. And we didn't have an option to do a maneuver. We're working with our Russian partners to see if we can shorten the timeline to do maneuvers. You know, today it takes us a couple days to actually get the maneuver timeline loaded in station and actually try to do a maneuver to avoid debris. We're working with the Russians to make some software changes where we can do that in a much more expedient manner. So if we get late notification of an object, we'll have the ability to move. And so we're working on improving that for the future.
Did you say you knew the size?
We don't know the size of it, and I don't have the mass of it. I've asked folks right now. It's just listed in the catalog as unknown, so then that means we don't know exactly where it came from, so therefore it's tough to get the mass and size. But if we get it, we'll get it to public affairs, and they'll let you guys know.
Thanks. And you touched on this in your comments earlier about the crew's Soyuz seat liners. So there's one that's going to be flying on 135, and the other three are just going to be in storage in case they're needed?
Yeah, they're in storage, and they could either be flown up on the Progress vehicle ahead of time and pre-positioned, or they could be launched on the Soyuz that would actually return those crew members. And we would make that decision, again, as we got into the situation on station. Would it be more critical to fly supplies up on the Progress, or would it be more important to get the seat liners up so then if they had a medical problem, they could come home on Soyuz? We would make that decision if the event occurred. But we've got a couple different options to get them on orbit.
Thanks. And probably for either you or for Mike Moses, do you have any other details about the particle that was found in the fuel valve, the size or what you think it might have been?
Let's see. The size was, I think it was eight microns by 14 microns.
Yeah,
it was
8 thousandths by 14 thousandths.
Yeah, unbelievably small. The picture they showed us was about the size of an 8.5, 11 sheet of paper, so it looked very menacing, but it was an unbelievably tiny particle. It's not uncommon to find debris in this fuel valve, and debris is a big stretch. Small contamination, the way this sits, that's kind of the natural sump as fluid would circulate through. All of this stuff is well below the contamination cleaning criteria. So this is stuff that's acceptable to the engine. The filters can handle it, all that. It just happens to probably got itself on a sealing surface, which generated the leak. And they were very hesitant to say that that's the root cause. We've seen this kind of stuff before that doesn't cause leaks. We've seen this stuff before that does. So it's not conclusive proof, but it is a good idea that that's a likely cause of that leak. One of the main problems with this valve that we've had in the long past, was there was not a purge downstream. And so as the liquid hydrogen gets on the upstream side of this valve, the downstream side forms nitrogen ice. It's cold enough that the nitrogen in the air solidifies right out and forms on the valve, which lifts up the sealing surface and then causes a small hydrogen leak. A couple thing, right? The temperatures are very small, and hydrogen is a very small particle, so it gets out very quickly. You don't need a very big gap before it leaks. And so we've long ago implemented this helium purge to kind of keep that out, and that's taken care of the problem. You can't ever tell if you had nitrogen ice, because by the time the valve cools down enough, or I should say warms up enough, to be able to go out and take a look at it, the ice is melted and it's gone. So we weren't surprised that we didn't find a smoking gun. We were kind of feeling a little good that we found this little piece of particle, but the bottom line is the new valve should be just fine, and the true bottom line is if it happens to leak again, we have all the right protocols and procedures in place to keep us in a safe configuration out at the launch pad. It would result in another scrub, but that would be what the right thing to do that day if this leak does come back again. But we don't have any reason to suspect that we didn't get rid of the problem by changing out the valve.
Todd? Todd Halverson of Florida Today for, Gersh, maybe Mike Moses. I've been thinking about the number of EVAs you guys have been doing annually for 10 or 11 years now, and it probably ranges about 15 or 20 if I'm not mistaken. And I was wondering, now that assembly is done, how many EVAs a year do you anticipate having to do to maintain the space station? And I have a follow-up.
I think we're looking at about one EVA a year is roughly what we're predicting. And again, they'll be predominantly for maintenance kind of activities. There may be a little bit of payload activity associated with that. What we'll do is we'll wait until enough things back up in the job jar that we're ready to go do an EVA. You can kind of see what the Russians are doing with their EVAs. They're going to do an EVA this summer. They're doing about one to two EVAs a year, so I think we'll be in about that same range, probably one EVA or so a year once we're done. We're really done with assembly, so now we're done with assembly. Now we're more just maintenance.
Right, so that would be a total of about three or four, two U.S., two Russian?
Yeah, probably I would say three. Probably two Russian and one U.S.
Okay.
And the other thing that you're going to start to see us doing, too, is we're going to start using Dextra for more activities. You know, we had planned about a year ago to do a remote power control module change out with Dextra, remember, and we tried to pull, and the forces were larger than we thought, so we had to reprogram Dextra to use both arms instead of just one to pull, because when it was just pulling on one, there was too much bounce when the device came unstuck. So we're going to go do that again probably this fall. You'll also see us doing all these refueling tasks that Mike talked about a little bit earlier. That's going to really ring out Dextra as being able to do some pretty interesting tasks that before would have only been done with EVA. So you're going to see us start moving up now on the robotic side to do much more robotic kind of things, because a lot of our orbital replacement units are meant to be replaced with robotics. So even back to Jay's comment, there are some components out there on the station that you would have said today were only EVA interchangeable or fixable. I will tell you, in the future, we start using Dextra, you're going to start seeing us doing a lot of robotic maintenance on the outside with Dextra to keep up components. So that's kind of the next phase. So we went through the EVA phase. Now we're going to push the robots to see how far we can get with maintenance with robots, and that's coming on station.
That's really interesting. I'm thinking you guys have done, 159 or 160 EVAs now to assemble the space station, and it seems to me that there have not been a whole lot of you know, big deal kind of events or incidents that have happened. If you look back at the assembly period, what would you say were the most significant, you know, events? I can remember an ammonia leak on the Destiny install mission and the stuff with the gloves. I mean, what would you say were the most significant things you've encountered?
Well, that's tough. You know, when you're sitting in mission control and you're running your flight plan, any little thing seems like it's a big deal to you. But when you step back at the end of the mission and you look at the recap, you know, I don't know that there's very much on that list. Even those ammonia couplers that had problems, that was not an unanticipated thing. We had the backup plans we needed. We had a few areas that have gotten nicknames like the rat's nest and stuff where there's a lot of connections and a lot of access difficulties. And again, they were known to be challenge points. And I think what you take away from it is not so much the things that went wrong, but all the work that went in to make sure that they didn't go wrong. I think the number of opportunities to have an issue with an EVA in a station assembly was a very big number. And the team did an amazing job of making sure we never found ourselves in one of those situations. So I can think of more examples where we avoided a problem than we actually had problems. And that's a testament to the EVA team and the station team to come up with a very good system that's got a lot of robustness to it.
We'll take questions from two more reporters here, then we'll head off to Johnson Space Center, the phone line, and then back. So,
if I might line back. This is obviously the last time you're going through the FRR process for a shuttle mission, and many of the workers working towards this last mission know that they're going to be out of work and losing their jobs once the orbiter's back down on the ground again. How does everybody here separate that emotion, that knowledge in their minds from the need to do a thorough and professional job preparing for this last mission? And can you also tell me a little bit more about the general mood and atmosphere around KSC as the program winds down, please?
Yeah, I think you used the right word. You used the word professional in describing the team. And that's not just the launch team. It's the processing team. It's the ground support team. Everyone that touches the vehicle or the ground support equipment is a true professional here at the Kennedy Space Center and indeed throughout the program. And so with that professionalism and their dedication to the program over many, many years comes a commitment, an internal commitment to do the job right. And as I said before, when the folks are doing their work on this amazing machine, I don't worry about it. I know they're going to do their job as perfectly as they have in the past. Yes, they know the end is coming, of course, and we've known it for quite some time. Contractors have done a great job in preparing the workforce for other opportunities out there. But nevertheless, you know, the end of a program, something that a lot of these folks have been with for 30 years, it's difficult. And the mood is getting more and more somber as you walk down the hall. When you're not on the job site, you're walking down the hall talking to folks. You know, the end is just weeks away now, where it used to be years away. So it's turning more somber. But you know, we're looking forward to the future too, and what NASA has planned in the future, and hopefully that'll be exciting for the Kennedy Space Center too.
Last question here before we go to JSC from Craig Cavalt.
Thanks very much, Craig Cavalt with Aerospace America. And pitching it toward the future here, what kind of intensive inventory exercise is underway from a component point of view, the kind of hardware that you can shift over to the SLS, the Space Launch System, that's at least in a conceptual vein now, and I'm particularly interested in SSMEs and SRMs.
So let's see. From a we've known about that for a while, even long before SLS got defined. We've kind of had that lean against our hardware to say, you know, what does the follow-on program need? You know, we decided the SSMEs were an asset that we likely need. The program, with Bill's help, went out on a limb a little bit to say, let's go ahead and protect them in storage a little longer. And then we come up with a system that might need to use them. It looks like we might be headed that way, so those assets are available. All the SRB hardware is being stored in not flight condition storage, but in a reasonable enough shape that it's reusable and restorable if needed. And then there's the detailed specifics of plumbing components, valve components, that you really need to get a little more maturity on the design of the next vehicle before you know exactly what you may or may not want to take from this program's hardware. And so we have all the mechanisms in place to go identify that hardware and then be able to take it out and keep it in a flight spares condition if needed. But that's still an ongoing process. It's basically underway right now at the Marshall Space Flight Center to identify what hardware may or may not be needed. And it's open work pending on all three vehicles as we retire them down here at Kennedy to decide what needs to come out and be saved.
And I just might add a little bit to that, too. From a ground processing perspective, we're going through essentially that same process. You know, we're identifying ground support equipment that may be applicable to some future program, or if it's truly shuttle unique and probably will never be used by another program, well, that's a different story. But things like an ammonia servicing cart, well, most space vehicles have ammonia on board, and so things like that, we're taking special care not to throw away. We're inventorying it all. We're going to keep it in good shape for the future. Hopefully, another customer will want those types of ground support equipment items as well.
We have a transition control board where we kind of look at each individual component, each individual facility, and then we try to make our best judgment about, is this something we might be able to use? Is this something that we're not going to use? Those are the two broad categories, and then there's this kind of in the gray zone. And then we try to figure out where we think our highest probability is to keep stuff around, and we also look at how easy it would be to replace if once we let it go. That's another consideration, and we actually write a pretty thorough document where we analyze each one of these components to see what its value is to the future program, its ability to be replaced, and the criticality, and then we make a decision about whether we want to keep it around for an extended duration or not. So it's a pretty thorough process. We've gone through it for a lot of the major components up to this point. We'll continue to do that through the remainder of this year.
Thanks. Okay, well, let's take questions now from Houston, the Johnson Space Center. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks, Mark Caro for Aviation Week. I think this is for Mike Linebach. Once the launch period opens on July 8th, how many days can you go before you have to reservice the PRSD in order to preserve the 12-day mission? Can you go through the 10th? Is that what you implied earlier, or is that too long?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Craig. We can go all the way through the 10th with no problems at all. And again, if we're still on the ground after the 10th, you know, I suspect the shuttle program, along with the Delta program, will talk about other opportunities. But right now, we're saying we have the 8th, 9th, and 10th to launch, and we would not have to top off PRSD in that time frame.
Hi, this is Robert Perlman with CollectSpace.com with a question, I think, for Mike Moses. I believe the current projections are that if Atlantis lands on any other day but July 20th, it'll be a night landing. Is that correct? And would there be any consideration by the program, because this is the last landing, to do some type of other orbital maneuver to bring back landing to the day so that the last landing can be seen in full daylight? Thanks.
Yeah, Robert, no specific accommodations being made just for that reason. But, yeah, the landing time would back up a little bit. There's a whole list of constraints that go into deorbit burn planning, cross-range capability, attitude, lighting conditions are one of them. You want to avoid the direct glare of sunrise or sunset. So we'd go through that whole list, and that would drive what the right burn or orbit adjustment to get the burn where it needs to be. But no, nothing on that list says try to make it a daylight landing just because it's the last one.
Gina Sinceri, ABC News for Bill. Bill, would you take me to what happens when you get notice of a conjunction, the process, who gets the phone call at midnight, and what steps you take and how you analyze it?
Yeah, typically what happens is the flight dynamic officer, I think it's the, it's got a different name in the station world, but it's essentially the person that keeps track of the orbital mechanics of the station and does reboost planning, those kind of things. They'd get a notification. They would immediately inform the flight director. The flight director would then have discussions with the Russian counterparts about what needs to be done. The ISS program would be brought into the same discussion to make sure that programmatically they're aware of what's occurring. If management is needed to make a decision, the ISS mission management team would make that decision on what the planning is for the burn that needs to be done. So if we know in advance, we'll start this process and we'll kind of do the preliminary paperwork. We'll exchange the burn information with the Russians to get ready for that activity. But then when we get like an immediate notification of this one, I think we had 14 hours notice before the event. In that case, the flight director was immediately contacted. The flight director then informed the ISS program management team. They informed broader management. And then we worked out with the crew, and the flight rules are pretty specific about what we do for these cases. And it was essentially to shelter in place, to get into the respective Soyuzes and actually close the hatches and prepare in case something occurred. And so that's the basic process that we go through.
And on the station side, that's the TOPO, the Trajectory Operations Planning Officer.
Yep.
That's all the questions from JSC. So let's go to the phone line and see if Denise Chow has any questions.
Hi, Denise Chow with space.com. A question for Mike Moses. You mentioned that for adding an extra day, you'll wait until either the second or third day of docked operations. Is that the latest time that you can make that decision, or can you sort of do a wait and see longer than that and hold off on making that decision of adding an extra day?
Yeah, conceivably, we certainly could wait, and we would do so if we were kind of marginal on the support numbers. Talking to the mission operations team and the planning folks, the day that they think they'd add is around the flight day 8-9 time frame is where you'd kind of insert that extra day. So the crew would be running the normal plan up until that time. You'd like to give them a little notice so they have time to replan and reschedule. But yeah, we could certainly wait a little longer, probably flight day 5 or 6. Till we need to make any decisions.
Denise, any other questions?
Not with that. Thanks.
Okay, I think that was it. So we're back here at Kennedy and Jay Barbary.
Bill, we got the announcement on the multi-purpose crew vehicle and everything here not too long ago. Is there any hope of getting an announcement anytime soon on heavy lift?
We're working through all the trades and all the analysis that goes along with that, and I don't know. We'll see. We're working as fast as we can to get some kind of announcement out as soon as we can.
Be nice to have it for the launch.
Marcia?
Marcia Dunn, Associated Press. Two quick questions for Bill. Did I hear you say earlier that this piece of debris that went by the space station this morning was the closest piece of junk has ever come to the space station?
Yes.
That's what I heard. And everything's looking great for the 8th, but if the launch slips significantly, is there a line in the sand or any kind of date where you just can't afford to keep the shuttle sitting on the pad since it is the last one?
Again, I think we have sufficient funding to keep trying for another period of time. We need to keep working with the teams and make sure we're really ready to go do this mission. As I described earlier, this mission is really, really critical to an ISS standpoint. So we want to do this mission, but we got to make sure that in our zeal to get this mission done, we don't cross some safety line where we don't have adequate support to go staff the mission, or something's occurred from a team standpoint that is not right. You know, we'll do the right thing overall, but we, you know, we have funds to go ahead and continue for a while if we have to keep slipping. And our intent would be to fly this mission as long as we're ready to go fly this mission in a safe manner, and we'll continue to evaluate that as we go forward.
For a while, how would you define for a while?
I don't know. A couple months.
Yeah, let's take a question here.
And then you know how we work things, right? I'll tell you a couple months now, and then I'll figure out some magical plan, and we'll extend that a couple more months. So the immediate answer is a couple months.
Okay, Todd, and then we'll take a question from Richard.
Okay, Todd Halverson of Florida Today. For anybody who would like to field this one, a lot of people are going to be looking back at 30 years of shuttle operations and the money spent over time to have adventures in low Earth orbit, and I'm thinking that some people out there are going to question whether the shuttle program was worth the expense. And I'm wondering, if you got that question from somebody on the street, what would your answer be and why?
It's Kirsten Meyer's money.
Well, I'll start, and these guys can help me, right? I would say it's definitely worth our money. I mean, if I look at what we've accomplished, you know, when we started this program, as you described earlier, right, we could barely do spacewalks, right? And then look how many spacewalks we were able to do throughout the history of the shuttle program, not only for ISS assembly, but in general. you know, we've gone from where we went to space and we touched space and we came back. We now are really in a posture where we're learning to live in space and operate in space, which I think is a tremendous challenge to us as a species and also helps us and drives us from a technology standpoint. I would also say if you look at how computational fluid dynamics has changed, you know, what we can do today in terms of debris loss is light years different than what we could do before. And that same computational fluid dynamics helps us design better aircraft engines, helps us design better wings for aircraft. It pays real benefits to real folks here on the Earth. We understand combustion properties much better than we've done before. I mean, that has real benefits. So the technology advance of taking a step or pushing beyond what you think is reasonable and going for that high bar and setting that high standard for yourself drives better performance for the team. I can also tell you that there is no better workforce than this workforce down here at Kennedy and Houston and throughout the world that supports space. These folks are tremendously dedicated. Their ability to plan and to schedule is phenomenal. You know, they have a valve failure, and they immediately have got plans in there. High crews out there figuring out how to get scaffolding out there. The engine guys come tell me it's as good as changing it out in the engine shop. They put the platforms in place so they could get there. There wasn't a whole lot of fuss and muss. They know what their job is. They know how to go do things. They know how to plan. They know how to react. And that's invaluable in any industry or any skill. So these skills that people have individually learned that fit on their resumes today are invaluable for the future. So I, you know, I'm clearly biased because I've been doing this my whole life. But I will tell you that I think this has really pushed our country well. We have done a tremendous service for our country in advancing technology and scientific research. And the program was clearly worth everything we spent on it to this point.
Yeah, I'd agree, right? The technical, tangible things. You know, one of the things that the Kennedy engineering team kind of used as a lesson learned the other day is as we've gone through all this problems we've had with orbiter wiring and how it ages over the years and the fact that you can't get at all of it, they developed a technique that basically kind of does remote scanning. You send a high current signal down that wire, and it can come back and tell you if you're bleeding out current because you have an insulation break somewhere. That's now technology that's out there in industry being used around the world to help reduce the manpower required to track down wiring problems. So there's all those tangible direct benefits. I'll step back and say it's the intangible stuff that always inspired me. The fact that it's a noble purpose to go do this kind of thing in space that is just an inspiration. I mean, to think about the stuff we're doing robotically, and somewhere there's some kid watching Dexter out there remotely manipulating things and comes up with some idea of how we can do that differently. It drives all the surgical robotics that we do here on the ground. All that, one doesn't cause the other, but as a collective, it shows what the advancement of science and technology really does for our species as a benefit. If you think about what we have available to us technologically today as opposed to what, you know, the generation before us had, it's pretty remarkable. To me, that the space program is an inspiration to keep pushing on that. And so I think, just like Bill, every dollar was worth it.
And I think, you know, from my perspective, I take a little bit of a different view of it. I'm more of a philosophical person when it comes to describing the benefits of the shuttle program and the station program. You know, we've gone into international partnerships in low Earth orbit, something that hadn't been done before except for one test flight. We started that with the Mir program and proved that we could do that with the Russians. International Space Station program, look at that and the partnerships that have evolved over time there. And it's not too much of a stretch to think of Star Trek and the international flavor of the bridge of the spaceship Star Trek, the Enterprise. So we're really beginning the next step of evolution in off of the planet Earth. I mean, exploration is in the human soul. It's what we do. It's part of what makes humans human. And I believe learning to live and work in low Earth orbit is the next step in that evolution. And the next step after that will be to maybe back to the moon, maybe to a near Earth object, maybe to Mars. I don't know. But I do know that learning to live and work in low Earth orbit was the next logical step, and the shuttle program has proven that, and it's part of an evolutionary process that the species will go through for eons. And so we will look back on this. I'd like to be reincarnated 200 or 300 years from now and see what marvels are going to be with us on this planet and elsewhere. Um, course, that's not possible. So we're doing now what we're setting up for the next step in the evolution of space exploration, and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
We'll take one last question here from Richard before we let these gentlemen go for the day. Go ahead.
Richard Luskin for The Guardian, for anyone who fancies it. We're now about to enter a period, an extended period, of no manned launches from the American space program here. And when previous programs have finished, there's always been a follow-on program coming. There's still uncertainty now. What sort of things do you point to that NASA's going to continue to do during that period to inspire children to continue to want to take up careers in science and engineering and space? How difficult is it going to be without launches taking place from here to keep that inspiration?
You know, I think one thing we need to think about is how we use station in more of a real world. You know, it's really nice when you can come here to Kennedy and you can watch a launch, because then, in a sense, you can participate in that launch, right? You can see the launch, you can feel the sound waves reflect off your body, and in a sense, you get a real tangible feel for what's going on. What we need to think about is, in station, through maybe internet connections, let students actually robotically now program spacecraft that fly inside space station. So how can we give more of a real feel to students of what's going on with space station, so they can get a sense that they're part of the program and it's not just a select few folks doing experiments in space? How can we make station activities more real to students? And we see that even, you know, we're doing some of these tweet-up activities here where we bring folks in to talk about things. We're doing some, Ron Guerin's doing a fragile planet activity from space station and connecting through social media with folks here on the ground. So we need to figure out a way that we can bridge a more tangible, real feel to what we're doing on station, so station doesn't get bypassed. You know, there's lots of benefits on station that can occur. We may find there's some medical things that are better investigated in space than they are on the ground. That may spawn off a commercial market for some of those medical things, and might be another commercial space station dedicated to that particular activity. So we need to see this transition of where it was predominantly a government activity to now where it'll be maybe some more commercial activities. You're starting to see that a little bit with the cargo resupply of station. We'll see how those new cargo resupply companies come online this year. They're going to do their demonstration flights this fall and then start more regular service next year. That's going to be a huge challenge for them. As we know how difficult it is to operate spacecraft and launch vehicles, it'll be interesting to see how they step up to that. That's another opportunity for students and kids to get involved in that activity. And then commercial crew may come along online. It won't be too long until we've got the Orion capsule, the Orion MPCV, multi-purpose crew vehicle, started. So we're off working in that activity so we can get some students involved in that too. So I think we need to take advantage of this period and don't let the momentum that we have right now fall behind and then just fall back on our heels and just sit back and lament about what we had. We need to be looking forward about what the future is and driving for that future, or our politicians are not going to support that future. If we, the space community zealots, don't push for that future, there's no way we can expect the politicians to step up and give us a future and point us in the direction. We need to stay united, keep moving forward, and show folks why we work so hard for what we do every day here. Mike and Mike.
You said it great.
All right. Well said. Thank you very much. I want to invite you to tune in to NASA Television on Thursday for a full day's worth of STS-135 pre-flight briefings beginning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. On July 4th, the Commander Chris Ferguson and his crew arrives here at Kennedy Space Center at 2:45 p.m. That also will be carried live on NASA Television. And again, launch now officially set for July 8th, 11:26 a.m. Eastern Time. You can keep track of STS-135 and all the activities on the NASA website at www.nasa.gov/shuttle. Thanks again for coming.